Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Well, well, we're starting anyway. To heck with it. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of Crash Palace Productions, The Last Knock, our podcast. I am your host, Billy Crash, and today there is no Johnny Numb. He's outside herding cats because that's what he loves to do because he's crazy like that. And we are talking to an absolutely phenomenal actor who I've loved, admired, and respected for many moons. You first saw him in Humanoids from the Deep. He's been in Halloween 2. A chuckle from that. Lost Highway. The Tailgate Driver, if you remember that. Now it's ringing bells. Starship Troopers. My gosh, so many. And Night Creep. Mother's Day Massacre. Night of the Living Dead 3D. Halloween 2 with Rob Zombie. And, forget it. We could go on forever just naming all your films. It is the wonderful Greg Travis. Greg, how are you today?
Couple of Tobe Hooper films, too, for the horror fans. Toolbox Murders.
Yes.
Tobe Hooper version. And
yes.
Mortuary.
Yep.
Very little known Tobe Hooper film that he did after Toolbox with the same writers.
Yes, indeed.
That was a lot of fun. I kind of regret what I did on Mortuary because I really did this comedic character, and then I read a review later that said they didn't know if it was a horror movie or a comedy based on my performance in the film, and I was like, oh no. You know, but he liked it. We were doing it. I mean, we were shooting it. He didn't tell me not to, you know, do it that way. So
then that's good. You did.
Instead of going creepy, I went more comedic with my character. And so I guess it didn't jive with the overall sort of tone of the film or whatever. But
well, we thought it worked.
You know, you make these choices, and you just never know. You never know.
Well, so how does that happen, Greg? Like you get a script and the character pops into your head and you're like, yeah, I want to do this, and you know, you just give it a go.
Well, that particular one, they just offered it to me because we had gotten along really well on Toolbox and they liked what I did, and so it was the same group of producers and writers and Toby.
Right.
So sometimes you get offers, like with Starship Troopers. I'd worked with Paul Verhoeven on Showgirls,
yes.
And we got along great, and so he just offered me the role of the reporter in Starship Troopers. I didn't have to, you know, I mean, they're working with you for months on end, so they know what you can do, and,
sure.
You know, he knew that I could do that. So in those circumstances, it's fun, because you don't have to go through all the rigmarole of the auditions and the wondering and the waiting and all that nonsense, you know.
Right.
And so it's a lot more, it's just a lot more professional, a lot more respectful to get it that way. But
sure.
You know, the relationships you make with directors and casting directors, you know, is sort of like where your main work comes in, and they know your work and they remember you for the next project.
Sounds so logical. That's good.
Yeah, that can be very lucrative and a whole lot more less stressful, I'll put it that way.
But
to answer your question, I kind of got diverted. To answer your question, yeah, you get the script and you look at the character and you see, well, what can I do with this? And what can I do that's a little different? And, you know, who is this guy? And you make your notes and you sort of figure out sort of what the character is and what might be interesting, and you know, you just kind of like create, you know, a character based on what you have to work with in the script.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, even with Starship Troopers, you're such a standout. I mean, it works so well. You know, it's an ugly planet. It's a bug planet.
Well, it was fun because of the dying twice in the same film was kind of a unique thing because it's a flash forward.
Yeah.
At the beginning of the film, so it's like you were in the middle of the movie and they started with that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of a fun thing, and we were at a old Indian burial ground. Can you believe that?
So hard.
It was this huge rock formation pit, and so they had to de-snake it because it was full of snakes.
Oh.
But it was also an old Indian burial ground. And,
man.
You know, it was like one of Casper, Wyoming is where it was, in the middle of nowhere. And they shot at night. And then it would rain every 2 hours.
Oh, man.
It would come a downpour. Yeah, it was weird. So we'd all run under these tarps, and then they would, like, when it quit raining, they would turn on these huge fans, dry the dirt out again, and then we'd get started again. But, yeah, it was pretty amazing.
Wow.
Yeah. And they had no idea that it was going to be such a cult hit. I mean, when it came out, it kind of missed the mark with the big blockbuster type audience,
right?
And the reviewers didn't get the irony and the satire of it.
Not at all. No, they didn't. They missed the mark completely.
They didn't get it at all. And now it's become like a cult classic. People can't get enough of it. You know, it's on TV all the time.
I love it. I absolutely love the film. And you know, some people would jibe me for loving it, and I was like, you don't know what you're talking about. And then the director, Takashi Miike, who did Audition and some other, he said that's his favorite movie, and I'm like, all right. I feel justified. And I have the movie poster.
I saw that audition film a long time ago, and I just remember, is that the one where the girl is poking someone in the eyeball with the little needles?
Yeah, she's poking him in the face.
Yeah, I thought that was the one.
Yeah, acupuncture.
That was pretty creepy, yeah.
Yeah. Well, speaking about creepy, you've been in a lot of creepy films, and what was it like? I'm sure you have 8 million stories, and that's what I know everyone wants to hear. I know Johnny Numb, my co-host, was like, ask him what it was like working with Rob Zombie on Halloween 2. So it's like, so that's what I'm asking you.
That was a lot of fun. We did it in Atlanta, and sort of out in these little, like, Confederate towns that were, like, still had all the architecture and some of the old homes. They were, like, one of the ones that weren't burnt down. And
right.
So they were, like, these little towns that we would stay in when we were, we were out of the country, most of it. And they found all these little creepy houses to shoot at and little sheriff's offices in these downtown areas and stuff like that. So I was a cop. And, you know, he put a mustache and sideburns on me. And it was fun. It was fun. He was a great guy, real easy going. And I had worked with his wife, Sherry Moon Zombie, in Toolbox Murder.
Yeah.
She had a role in that. So she remembered me from that. And then had another couple of friends who were working on it. And so it all worked out. And he's done quite well in the horror genre. I don't really have any specific, you know, incredible stories that happened during the film other than... when the big guy who, I think it was Taylor Main, played the Jason.
Right.
Was it Jason? Or is that another? Do I have that right?
Halloween's Michael Myers.
Michael Myers, I'm sorry.
That's okay. They blend after a while.
Michael Myers, yeah. He played Michael Myers. And so when he went to grab me and choke me or whatever he was going to do to kill me, I fought him. I fought him pretty hard, and I elbowed him, and I kicked at him, and I hit him a few times, and he was like, yeah, that's good, I like it, you fought me, you know. I'm like, yeah, well, you know, you're not going to stand there and just let somebody kill you. I mean, you know.
Yeah, oh, yeah, sure.
If somebody gets you around the neck, you're going to squirm and, you know, try to wiggle out of it.
Yeah, fight for survival.
Exactly, exactly. I see a lot of these... deaths in movies where people just lay down, you know.
Like, yeah. Oh, you know. Yeah, exactly. So what was...
Polanski wrote a whole paper about that. He was trying to figure out how hard it is to knock somebody out and then to kill somebody in this film he was doing. And so it was like this whole article where he had this huge discussion on how difficult it would be to kill somebody. It's not easy, you know.
No.
People are pretty tough. It's not... as easy as you would think to kill a person, you know?
No, exactly. I hate it, like, when I do any writing and I research, and it's really horrible and I hate myself for it, but I actually look up maybe actual videos of, you know, people somehow meeting their doom, just, you know, like, how would it really happen, or, you know, like, to talk to a friend who was going to school to be a doctor. So I had asked him stuff because he'd been at a morgue, like how do people really look, and just to get it right, because it's often so wrong, you know. And like you said,
also they have people that they pronounce dead that wake up in the morgue. You know, that happens all the time. How would that be?
Yeah, yikes indeed. Oh man,
I'm telling you, man, it's not as easy as you think, you know. So
no, it's not, and neither is what you've accomplished. I mean, you started out in 1978. What drew you to acting? Was this always in your blood from birth?
I made a couple of full length feature movies in high school, and then right out of high school. One called Joe Dynamite and the other one called Future Circus. And mm-hmm. we had the Super 8 with sound camera. And it had two little stripes of sound, one for music, one for recorded dialogue. And so, you know, we would we'd have to edit with that in mind. And we did whole features with Super 8 and showed them. And, you know, I actually made a profit on my first one, and showing it at the high school for 3 nights. And I said, hey, I can do this movie business. This is no big deal. little did I know. But, I came out pretty early on. I think I went 1 year. I got an associate arts degree, or maybe a little more than 1 year in Dallas. And then I came out to Hollywood and went to film school at a place called Sherwood Oaks Experimental College. And while I was going to film school, I started going up and doing stand-up because I was a magician all through high school. And I did, you know, magic shows and very much into, you know, comedy magic and that type of thing. And so it was a natural step up to try stand-up comedy.
Right.
And I actually was pretty good at it and started getting a few opportunities right away.
Mm-hmm.
And so after about a year of film school, I kind of transitioned into the stand-up world, and I did that for almost maybe 19, 20 years.
Jeez!
Stand-up comedy, yeah.
I hear so many people get burnt out from doing stand-up. It's like...
Well, I did. I mean, that's, you know, one of the problems with it is just, you know, I had a great act, and it changed as the years went along, and, you know, and I tried all kinds of different shows, and... you know, I got a lot from it. I got a lot of, you know, TV work, and I did a lot of TV spots from it, and I did a ton of road work, and I opened for Cher, and Tom Jones, and Dolly Parton, and then I headlined all the comedy clubs around the country.
Mm-hmm.
And it just became, I was making good money, but it just became a very difficult lifestyle, living out of a suitcase, always traveling all the time.
Yeah.
And so I couldn't really pursue acting while I was doing that.
Right.
I had to kind of get off the road for a while and then, you know, kind of redirect my energies towards an acting career.
Mm-hmm.
And got lucky enough to grab a couple of roles in Showgirls and a few other things. And that kind of launched my, I had done a few movies, about 5 or 6 movies before that, but that one was the really, you know, great break for, you know, being in a fairly big budget film. I think it was about a $40 million movie, so.
Yeah, good old Showgirls. That has a
that
has a special following.
I knew it was going to be a little weird because I kept asking Paul about the script. I go, are you really going to say that? I mean, is that line necessary? Are you think that's the way to go? And he stuck with the script. He wouldn't let. I mean, I changed my lines anyway, but I mean, I just rewrote them so they were more naturalistic. But he wouldn't let anybody change anything. He did it.
Wow.
I guess his idea was that he was hired to shoot that script, and so that's what he was going to do.
Gotcha.
In case it all went awry, he could always blame the writer, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And he did. He said, well, that, you know, I shot the script the way it was, so, you know. But it has moments. I mean, it's not a complete disaster. I mean, there's certain parts of it that are pretty good, but you know, it's a soap opera-y kind of you know, chicks, you know, fighting and battling each other. So the tone of it is very delicate. You've got to get the right tone for that thing, otherwise it could be comedic realm.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And you're really good at finding that balance, which isn't easy to do for a lot of people. You know, between comedy and drama and comedy and even horror. I mean, that's such a, you know, diametrically opposed, you know?
Yeah. Well, the funny thing about horror, the reason I prefer kind of a horror genre for my films is mm-hmm. because you can still do a lot of humor. You can still right. have your characters be very funny in a kind of a different way where they're not like going for the laugh and they're not trying to be funny. They just are funny because they're in more of a heightened situation. So the tension actually creates a better setup for the comedy. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, it's funny. That's one of, because I love comedy horrors, but there's certain horrors where they just don't get that right.
And they have actors that might not understand that they don't have to go for the funny.
Right.
Like, what I mean by remember the wheelchair guy in the Texas Chainsaw? He was kind of comic relief, you know? He was kind of just a quirky character that was, you know, you kind of felt sorry for him, but at the same time, you're kind of laughing at him. That kind of a thing.
Right.
To me, that's more interesting humor and comedy than, you know, going for the laugh or having some campy character that is, you know, trying to be funny. I don't like that so much. It just doesn't hold up very well. You know, it kind of, once you've seen it once, you don't really need to see it again. I like things that are a little more subtle.
Right.
Are a little more classical and last longer so you can watch them over and over again and get something new every time.
No, I agree with you. That's why, you know, my co-host Johnny and I, we'd been talking about Mortuary a couple of shows ago, and we both enjoyed the film, and we didn't think, like, the comedy was out of place because that's what, you know, I call it human comedy. It's like, this is, I know people like this. This is what I would expect. So it doesn't make it a comedy film. It just adds to the realism of the actual drama. So,
right.
So you got it.
Yeah, and then you also try to make the character, even if it's heightened a little bit, you try to give it some reality and give it a, you know, a real a motivation so that it makes sense for the scene. And, you know, and it just adds some textures to the overall movie. You know, because horror, unless you're doing something that is so sober and so somber and you really need a very serious mood through the whole thing, most comedies need a little humor along. I mean, most horror movies need a little humor just to break the line of tension every once in a while, you know.
And the timing is everything with that, because I've seen movies where, like, it's like the director's letting you off the hook, and it's like, no, keep the tension there, man. You know, like, what are you doing?
I know. That is a hard thing to keep, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of the most difficult things that a filmmaker has to deal with is that line of tension, because, you know, you don't always have the writer thinking about that when they've got the scene progression, but when you get into the editing room, you've got to, like, oh, wait a minute, this scene totally detours the audience, and they forget that, you know, we need to be thinking about this guy getting into the castle or whatever it is.
Right.
You know, we've got to keep that thought in the minds of the audience while we're, if we do detours, they've got to be short and sweet so that they don't break that line of tension.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What were, now, this is going to be a transition into where I would like to go next, but what did you, you know, you've worked with, like you said, some, you know, great names, you know, Paul Verhoeven, you know, Toby Hooper, who we just lost, unfortunately, and, you know, Rob Zombie and the like. What did you...
Bob Raffleson.
Yes, yes.
David Lynch.
I know. What was it like working with David Lynch? I have to ask that first.
David Lynch was great. He's a real big kid.
That's what I keep hearing, yeah.
Just like you see him in those interviews, he's just a very enthusiastic, real good-natured guy.
Yeah, and, Eagle Scout, right?
Eagle Scout, Yeah, he's also got a more mature side to him when he's working. Mm-hmm. You know, most of the time we don't see him when he gets pissed off or angry.
Right.
But he does. He's got a temperament a little bit. And not bad, but, you know, normal for a director, you know.
Right.
When he's, like, having to wait too long for something or something's not working and he doesn't know what the problem is. Or, you know, he can get a little bit down to earth, I guess would be the right way to put it. You know, a little bit more human.
Gotcha.
You know, instead of this happy-go-lucky guy all the time. I mean, his work, I you know, to be honest, I don't know how he became such a knowledgeable film craftsman as he is.
Mm-hmm.
Because he came from this sort of art world, painter kind of school of thought. And his first film was just this, you know, super experimental, crazy crackpot.
Yeah.
Not much story, but, you know, he was just going for technique.
Yeah.
And then he turns around and makes The Elephant Man, which is like one of the most impressive film crafted, beautifully mm-hmm. lit and acted. I mean, just everything is almost perfect. You know?
Oh, yeah. No, I agree.
It's just, I don't know how he went from Eraserhead to that. You know, to that movie, it's just amazing to me. The guy has got an intuitive knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
He's very particular about every little detail. I mean, he would get in there and, like, adjust the makeup on actors.
Wow.
No, your sores needs to be a little less, you know, it's a little bit too big. And, you know, he put the blood on my face when I was, like,
really?
Beat up. And, yeah. Yeah, he's super detail-oriented, and you know, which is kind of makes sense because his work is very all about those little details.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so, what was it like being on the ground and having Robert Loggia on top of you, like yelling?
It was fun. I kept telling him when he looked up and sort of like looked out over the hillside, but he was continuing to scream. His lines as he did, it just looked so crazy.
Yeah.
And I could even tell being underneath him that was going to be so, you know, because normally you would look down at the person you're screaming at, but when he looked up and like out over the cosmos, it was just so insane. And I said, oh, I love that. That's great, you know, when you did that. And so he kept doing it, and they left it in the film. It was really great.
Oh, yeah, it was.
He was a wonderful actor. I remember him from T.H.E. Cat when I was a kid.
Oh, my God, yeah.
He had this TV series called The Cat, T.H.E. Cat.
Yeah.
And he played a burglar who was a good guy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If you could figure that one out. But I don't think it lasted very long, but it was a very cool show, yeah.
Yeah, and it's funny because then you have, you know, looking at back at Toolbox Murders, you know, there's some creepy stills of you, you know, on the internet from that. So it's like
yeah, my death scene.
Yeah,
he sneaks up on me with a big pair of shears or like table cutters, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
Supposedly gets me in the back with them, and then I gyrate all over the place because I'm being short circuited or something. And you know, so we had a lot of fun with that. That was shot at the same hotel that RFK got shot at.
Oh,
so, we were,
by Sirhan Sirhan, yeah.
They've since torn that whole building down. They built something, an office building there or something. And
wow.
But we were in the old building, and Snoop Dogg was doing a video on the other side of the complex, and you could just smell the pot smoke coming over.
Oh, Snoop.
Yeah, it was pretty funny. Oh. I used to rent it out for movies and videos all the time.
Oh, man, yeah. I can...
yeah, working with Toby was great. He was really a cool guy. It's like he had that old kind of Sam Peckinpah personality.
Okay.
You know, where he was kind of, you know, just a tough old Texas guy that but he knew his stuff. He really knew his stuff. He knew what he wanted. When you gave him something good, he loved it. And, yeah, he was very, very, very knowledgeable director, very good director.
And that's pretty wild. And because I'm thinking of, oh my gosh, I was actually lost in an image of you because you've played Andy Warhol.
Yes.
In Watchmen.
Yes,
you've embraced him.
I did a little short for Saturday Night Live. I did a couple of shorts for them back in 86. And that was one of them called Andy Warhol's 15-Second Workout, and it's on my YouTube channel. Wait. And it was supposed to get played the very first show of the season, but it got bumped for some reason, and then it got put on later on. But I was going to do a bunch of short films for them, but I couldn't hang. It was just too unorganized, too crazy there.
Gotcha.
I don't know how they put on the show every week. It was just really weird. But, anyway, I was able to do those two, and then I met Andy at another opening he had, and I got him to sign my, I took a Polaroid of him, and I told him if he signed it before it developed, it'd be an original Warhol, and he just loved that. He was like, oh, that's perfect. And then I went to his, when I was getting ready for the SNL film, I went to his studio, and I told him what I was doing, and so they gave me the whole tour.
Right.
And then he came in at the end and started going through all these books, and I just said hi to him. And then I watched him for a while and kind of got a sense of who he was. And he was another guy, a little bit like David Lynch, where off camera and out of the limelight, he was a little bit of a different person.
Okay.
He had more of a down-to-earth, kind of a New Yorker thing going on than he did
right.
When you normally saw him in interviews. He would just play the dumb blonde and, you know, was kind of spacey and, you know, that whole thing. But he was a lot sharper and a lot more together than that, you know. He was, you know, he had to be. He's a, you know, world-renowned artist, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So he couldn't be just the space case that he presented to the world, you know.
Nah, he would have been used and abused a million times over.
Yeah, it's weird. They're both similar in that kind of aspect. Is that they have this sort of happy-go-lucky kind of, you know, persona, but then in real life they're quite a bit different, you know.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah.
Like you are, right?
A little bit. I like playing a lot of different characters because I can. I'm good at that. I did that in my stand-up.
Right.
You know, for so many years where I played all these different characters. Voices and impressions and all that kind of stuff. So I like to mix it up and do different things with each role, you know.
Yeah, and then you went on to get to not only write, which obviously you could do because you had your stand-up act, but then you producing and directing. And
yeah, well, while I was doing stand-up, I wrote constantly. I mean, I was constantly making short films and videos, and we were showing them in different places and on cable and whatnot. And then I also, I had a writing partner, Rick Overton, and we wrote comedy scripts for studios. We pitched and we got a few deals along the way, and we wrote some pretty good comedies. They didn't get made because of the studio system. And,
right.
You know, the producers involved evidently, you know, couldn't get them made, but we wrote about, I would say about four or five studio films, maybe four. And then
Rick's fantastic,
you know, we kind of got busy on our stand-up. He was a stand-up as well.
Yeah.
So we kind of got busy.
I loved his
doing
act.
That. But, I continued to write scripts, you know, all through the stand-up years and then as well in the acting years, trying to find a way to get them made is the hard part, you know?
Yeah. So you have to make your own damn movie, and that's when you...
Yeah, exactly.
And that's what you've
and
done.
I've made three films under my company banner, GTFilmProductions.com, and I've got Midlife now, which I did about 4 or 5 years ago, and then I've got Dark Seduction, which was my detective vampire black and white film noir. It's kind of a comedy horror and film noir, you know, parody.
Wow.
And so we did that one. I actually did that one back in the 80s, and it never got finished. But I finally was able to finish it up and get that out into the market. about 8 platforms now.
Yeah.
And then I've got this new one. Well, mm-hmm. It's not really new. I did it back in 05, but it got a foreign distributor who put it out foreign, but then they were going to turn around and do a American release, but they never did. I think they went out of business or something.
So yeah.
Got a foreign release, so I got it back, and then, I'm releasing it. Right now it's on Vimeo, and it's called Night Creep.
Right.
And it's got the late, great Don Calfa stars in that, and from Return of the Living Dead.
Yes.
And also about 100 other movies that he was in. Weekend at Bernie's. And,
yeah.
10, and, he did a hell of a lot of work. But great guy and great actor. And so he plays the night creep or the creepy landlord. And it's about a young stripper who moves into a new apartment. And she takes a drug called night creep. And then she believes that her landlord is coming into her room at night, doing very nasty things to her. And she's, kind of on her own. No one believes her. She doesn't even really know if it's really happening or if it's a dream or if it's the drug or what's going on. So it's kind of in the Lynchian territory of kind of a psychological thriller horror film,
Mm-hmm.
But it's about strippers, so what else do you need? There's a lot of nudity in it, a lot of beautiful ladies, and, it's a lot of fun, and it's a very kind of fast-paced. There's a lot of humor in it. There's a lot of funny characters in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to see it. Great in it.
He was great in everything he did. And
he was really good in it. And
checking that out.
We got that out now, and hopefully people will go to Night Creep and. If we can, we'll get it up on a few other platforms like Amazon and
sure.
maybe a couple others. But for right now, it's a Vimeo, VOD, is a rental or purchase. So,
right.
Yeah.
So how was it making that transition from being in front of the camera to telling, other actors what to do?
Starting in high school, I was directing, my big Super 8 movies back then. So, I think it's a little bit of both. As an actor, you're sort of directing yourself a lot of times anyway. You kind of come up with a character and you kind of come up with business to do. And if the director likes it, he'll leave you alone. If he doesn't like it, he'll change it.
Right.
But you're kind of, I won't say on your own, but you kind of have to come in with some ideas and try to make those ideas work.
Right.
Just as an actor anyway, because, that's your job. Mm-hmm. You got to bring the character to life.
True.
So it's not that much difference. A lot of actors transition into directing because you can see the process when you're acting on a film. You see how it's done and what needs to be done.
Right.
All I did was soak it all up working with all those big directors and just see how they work and what they do and how they direct. And
I'm sure.
It's just having the ability to have a vision and then try to execute that vision,
Right. What is your favorite kind of director to work with, actually? Is there a particular style that you feel... you best in, or?
Well, usually the good directors, they kind of leave you alone.
I knew you were going to say that.
If you're good and you're prepared and you really give them something that they can, sink their teeth into and work with, then they kind of leave you alone. They don't really, unless there's something specific that they have in mind that they want you to do, at a specific place, they kind of like, you've got the script, so it's assumed that you've worked on the script and you've fleshed out the character,
Right.
So, you know, when you start filming it, it's broken up into a lot of little pieces, so you've got to keep the continuity and keep the character and the energy up. But, you know, if you're pretty good at what you do, they kind of let you do it, you know? And
that's excellent.
I think that's the best way to work. It's only when you run into trouble of an actor who's not getting it, or their tone is not right, or the delivery's not quite right, then you kind of have to adjust them and try to get them to, you know, to go there and try to find out what the problem is and kind of, you know, help them any way you can in order to achieve what it is you're trying to do. So it's only when they're not up to snuff, as it were, that you really need to come in and do a lot of directing, you know.
Gotcha.
Unless it is a particular type of tone and energy and a specific type of thing that you're going for with that, with a, you know, with a character or with the overall tone of the movie that people are not aware of, but only you are aware of, then you have to constantly remind them, no, I want you to be bigger. I want you to really, you know, just do nothing and just, you know, keep it way down. And, you know, that's the director's job, is to sort of guide the ship, you know, and keep it in that lane so that it all comes together at the end.
Right. What did, so when you were making your films, especially like, you know, with Night Creep, because, you know, horror fans will be listening to this and we want to get them into it, of course. Were there any great, like, happy surprises on set that you were like, man, I didn't think that this would, like, this scene came out, like, completely different than I expected, and it's 10 times better than I imagined? Like, anything wild like that, or?
Yeah, you know, I mean, the rough cut was, like, 2.5 hours long. So
wow.
I don't know how. I always try to shoot a lot more than, obviously, I'm going to end up with in the movie. You know, sometimes you find, like, an old beat-up car, and so I had Don go out, and his son was there. He was kind of little at the time, so he was giving him this old beat-up car, and the kid didn't even want it. And, you know, so, like, we create, like, a little scene of, you know, he's like, yeah, when you get old enough, this will be yours, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And the kid just kind of like, nah, no thanks. He walks away, you know. It's just like, you know, any kind of, like, little extras that you can, you know, create, you just never know when you're going to, you know, need them, or if they'll come in handy, or, you know, sometimes it's a little transition scene, but, you know, I try to, like, you know, just, it was the same way on Midlife. I just, you know, shoot as much as I possibly can and improvise and just, you know, really give myself plenty of material to work with. And then, of course, the editing process, you chop it all down to its,
yeah,
you boil it down to its very essence so that it's the minimal amount that you need, you know. But,
yeah.
I love having a lot of stuff to work with. If there's anything that, you know, I would suggest, it's give yourself plenty of material, not just what's in the script. But
right.
You never know what little gem you can come up with when you're on a location and you see something interesting. Sometimes, you know, maybe just have a character walk past that thing, or, you know, sometimes, you know, little things like that will make it into the movie. You never know.
Yeah, so never yell cut right away.
That, and look around, see what you have to work with, and
right,
create some things, you know, with what you have to work with in front of you. When you go out on a location, you know, like, instead of just the house, you know, there might be a, you know, a pyramid mound in a field. Well, that pyramid mound in the field is more interesting than the house. What can we do in front of that pyramid mound in the field? You know what
right,
I mean?
Right.
So it's like you just look around and kind of, like, you know, take it all in and give yourself a little leeway. Don't just be stuck to just doing what's in the script. You know?
I gotcha. That sounds great to me. The,
yeah.
Oh, man. Oh, I had a...
A lot of happy surprises happened in Night Creep. I mean, working with Don Calfa, I just let him do basically whatever the hell he wanted. He plays a lot of different characters. We even had him in drag in one of the characters at the end, you know, which was really scary. I don't know how much of that made it into the movie. I think maybe just a little bit. I had to cut a lot of that out, but yeah, it was pretty funny to see such a character face in a little red dress.
Wow.
Yeah.
I gotta see that.
He was appearing, he's appearing to her in all of these different forms, and she's seeing him, you know, wherever she goes, and so he's sort of under her skin, and so we had him in all sorts of different outfits.
Oh,
and
man.
Looks. So, yeah, a lot of fun stuff in that, and the tone of it is kind of interesting. It goes from, I mean, they're all playing it straight, but because of the nature of it, it goes into some comedic areas, but it also goes into some very kind of sick and twisted areas, too. So
I like it already.
It's not exactly for the timid. It's, you know, it's a little bit, it gets a little bit rough at times, you know. So.
Oh, man, I like that. The It's funny what you were saying about playing it, you know, like, you know, you had them playing it straight, yet there's an odd feel to it. That was like, it reminds me always when Slim Pickens went to Kubrick and he said, how do you want me to play the role for, you know, oh my gosh, Dr. Strangelove. And he said, play it straight. He said, play it straight. And it's like, he's just, it's just incredibly hilarious at times, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Well, he's enough of a character.
Oh yeah.
So that whatever he says is funny anyway.
Yeah. You know? Exactly.
Just because he's so different from everybody else in the movie, you know. That's what I love about, you know, characters in a horror movie that are so interesting, and I don't want to say over the top, but they're bigger than life.
Right.
And
right.
So they don't need to do anything to be funny. They just need to show up and be there and be in the serious situation and talking like a hick or talking like they do, that's enough. You know, that will be enough to, you know, warrant laughter or warrant, you know, the differentness of it all, you know.
Right.
So, yeah.
What recommendations would you have for any, you know, young, you know, would-be or like, ah, I'm thinking about acting as a career, any warnings or like backup plan recommendations? Like, I know things are so different and then, you know, like even 20 years ago.
I would say learn the filmmaking side of it too, and I think a lot of the young actors do that. You know, I mean, a lot of people that are filmmakers, you know, they want to be actors. But there is a strict way to go about, you know, if you want to go to the good schools, if you can get some sort of a sponsor your first 2 or 3 years to help you so that you don't have to be a waiter or work a job,
right,
that you can focus in on your work. And you know, if you really look at it like a job, I think a lot of actors, they kind of do it half-heartedly, you know, I'll give it a couple of years, see what happens. But if you look at it like a job of getting out there and doing short films and getting enough footage on yourself playing various characters to make a reel, and then a website, and then networking with casting directors, and they have all these new things now that they didn't have when I was coming up, where these workshops,
right,
where you meet casting directors and everything, and they have to pay for all those. I don't know too much about that. I don't know if it's a good thing or...
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if they get work out of it or not. I'm not sure. I don't know anything about those. But, you know, that is one option to meet people and to meet casting people. And then write letters. I mean, you almost have to look at it as a full-time job. Spend 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, focused in on being on the internet, submitting yourself for things, and also writing letters, emails, making contacts, and just promoting yourself. That's really, you know, and if you can hire a PR agent and have enough money to do that, that's a good plus. I didn't do that as much as I should have earlier on. I should have spent more money also on stand-up and on acting, of being, you know, represented by a PR person all the time.
Right.
But it's expensive, you know. So, you know, it's catch as catch can. When you can afford to do it, do it. When you can't, you know, mm-hmm. there's not much you can do. But that is a big plus because, you know, as you know, in the film world, you know, people that have notoriety, like singers, even wrestlers, rock musicians, they tend to get cast easier because they have a huge fan base.
Absolutely. Yep.
And so producers think, well, if I put, you know, this rock musician in the movie, he'll, you know, all their fans will go see it, and that'll help sell tickets.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
That is one of the quirky sides of it, is that there's a lot of non-actors who become very big in movies just based on their fan base, you know?
Mm-hmm. Did you ever have to work with one as, like, their first time acting, and maybe they didn't act before, and you were like, did you want to strangle them, or did you want to help them out, or, you know?
No, but you work with actors who are there for some other, you know, maybe their father's a producer, or their, you know,
oh, okay.
dad is a director, whatever.
The nepotism got, thing, you know,
yeah. A series regular role, and they can't hardly say a line to save their life, but, you know, it's embarrassing for them, but what are you going to do, you know? I mean, that's, right. you know, that's part of it, is the nepotism and everything, but,
Well, you know,
I still act, and I still do parts from time to time, and
hopes to keep doing it.
Do more.
Yeah.
You know, for the last 5 years, I've been focusing on getting my films completed and out there, and we're sort of in a weird transition with this internet platform viewing and purchasing thing, where it's sort of caught on with some people, but then not with others, and older people are still not familiar or comfortable with watching movies on the internet.
And, right.
You know, but now that DVDs are sort of going out of vogue and this, you know, internet platforms, I think we're sort of at the ground floor of this whole revolution, you know.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
And I think it'll get bigger and bigger, mm-hmm. I do believe.
Well, pretty soon, I think, you know, what's going to happen is, congratulations, the television you bought is also your computer, and so it's like you're going to have access to, like,
right.
you know, I mean, you could, you know, a lot of people can do that now.
There's so sure. many platforms that are available for your TV.
Oh, yeah.
That you can go right to through your television. And mm-hmm. I'm not talking about Netflix or Hulu. I mean, you can go online through your TV and
yes.
find these different platforms mm-hmm. and do use them for there. It's just people learning how to do that, you know?
Right.
Because a lot of people, they look at their computer as their work unit, and then their TV as their entertainment unit, and never the two shall meet, you know? It's like
yes,
they don't
exactly.
understand how that works, you know? They're still cable-oriented, and so that's a big part of it. I mean, I feel like if I've got my movies in the marketplace and people have access to them, then, you know, hopefully they'll catch on and they'll be familiar with my work, mm-hmm. and then I can build. And then the next one, you know, might be a little bit bigger
right.
Budget and hopefully a bigger fan base, too. You know?
Right, because I was at a film festival 2 years ago, and it was interesting. I had a distribution panel. And the one gentleman had been working with his wife distributing films for 40 years. One guy's been doing it for 2, you know, and another guy was doing it for 10. And they all came up with the same idea. We have no idea where it's going. We don't know what, you know. It was pretty,
yeah.
It wasn't necessarily disheartening, but they were pretty much saying we're in the midst of, like, this incredible change, and the dust isn't going to settle for a while, so.
Yeah.
But it's just
crazy. Yeah, and it's, you know,
crazy.
It can work. There's, you know, a few films that have been, you know, low-budget, independent, that have gotten huge numbers on the platform sales. So we look at those things and, you know, we try to figure out what they did and, you know, how they worked it and, you know, what was the factor, the one element that people were interested in to go to their movie. And, you know, there's all of that marketing stuff that goes along with it, which is a big part of it, you know, the marketing, and people have to know the movie's out there.
Right.
And so they have to, you know, hear about it in order to want to go see it. So that is the, right now, that is the big bugaboo, because you end up spending more money on marketing in order to get the people to go to it than you do, you know, than you make back, you know,
yeah,
on the movie itself being out there. But slowly but surely, I think, you know, these kinds of movies will make their way into cable sales and mainstream media sales, and because content is content, and they definitely need plenty of it. You know?
Can't argue that point. So,
and sometimes, you know, independence can be better than studio films. I mean, there's such a sameness,
yes,
about studio films. It's very safe, and you kind of know what you're getting.
It's the formula, know? Yeah.
Yeah, it's you like something different.
Right. And
that is where the independent artist has the edge, is he can go outside the box and do something very different.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, that's what Tobe Hooper did. I mean, look at what he did with Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And, every time there's, like, a commercial horror movie, you know, a Hollywood horror movie, it's like, oh, they're going to play it safe, and they eventually do, and there's some sort of a semi-happy ending or something, and it's like, oh, man. You know, just, like, just didn't really work, you know, but...
Hang on, I've got a buzzer out my window here.
A buzzard?
Sorry, that's much better.
Okay, well, that sort of sucks.
Oh, there's always, you know, it's a nice neighborhood, but there's always some, you know, lawnmower or blower or something going on that drives you crazy after a while.
Well, you know, I didn't ask you this. The wonderful reason that you're on the show today is because our mutual friend Kent Harper. Which is great. How did you meet Kent? How did that happen?
We met online and just became phone buddies. And I've got Kent in mind for a part in my next movie, which is called Duct Tape Illuminati, and it's a horror film. And,
nice.
It kind of combines a little bit of Eyes Wide Shut with a little bit of I don't know what else. A few other influences, Rob mm-hmm. Zombie and Tobe Hooper influences, I guess. But
I love it already.
I just finished, you know, the first crack at the script, and with the co-writer Jed Curtis, and so we're going to develop that and see if we can get that made. And it's not a lot of humor in this one. I'm going for more of a dark tone and a serious tone, a little bit more straight horror.
Gotcha.
Not a lot of blood and guts, but enough scares to satisfy the horror fans, hopefully. And,
it's all about the suspense that you conjure, you know?
Yeah. And, to me, it's about, instead of throwing a bunch of, you know, unlikable, snarky teenagers in a, in a cabin in the woods, I wanted to do something a little bit different, a little bit more majestic, and a little bit more of a throwback to the older 70s horror films.
Oh,
you know?
Fantastic.
Where we get to know, there's two girl leads, and we get to know them a little bit before we throw them in harm's way. You know?
Gotcha.
So we have a little bit of affection for them, and we feel like we know them and we like them a little bit before we put them in the danger elements. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, well, you have to, or else then you can't be emotionally attached to the character.
But so many horror movies don't.
I know.
So many horror movies throw the characters
to the wolves,
into the muck right away, because they feel like if they don't, you know, get into the scary parts the first 10 minutes of the movie, that they'll lose the audience or something. You know, there's these formulaic kind of, you know, things floating around that people go by. But
yeah,
I think it's important. I mean, if you look at, you know, the classic movie, The Exorcist, the reason the whole end of the movie works so well is because they spend enough time in the beginning of the movie getting to know the little girl, getting to know
right.
the mother, so that we love these two characters. By the time they get to The Exorcist, we are totally freaked out by them having to go through this, you know. So it's much more effective that way. So the setup, and he set up the priest in the beginning of the film.
Yes, he did.
So well with that opening scene.
Oh, man, yeah, powerful.
I mean, what a great scene, and everybody told him to cut that scene, and he didn't, thank God. You know, he stuck to his guns and kept that in, and it just creates such a great setup for not only the priest character, but also the tone and the creepiness of the overall film.
Yeah. Oh no. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And is your wonderful sister Stacy going to end up in one of your films, or?
She might. She was in Dark Seduction. She played the detective's ex-wife.
Nice.
She looked like Veronica Lake when we met. She was like only 19, and so. Yeah, you'll have to check out Dark Seduction. She's really good in that.
And, oh, I will. No,
and of course, she's had a long film career too.
Absolutely.
And done a lot of television, and she's still working and involved with the union stuff, and one of the reps for the SAG union, and very much busy with all of that. So, she might end up in there.
Would be awesome.
Maybe I can kill her in one of my films.
All right, we won't tell her that part.
You always want to kill your sister. Come on.
Well, Greg, on that note, sir, here's my final question to you. For right now, because you're definitely coming on again. I hope you realize that. There's so much more ground to mine, but you've been on interviews before and you know, you've talked to press and such. What hasn't somebody asked of you that you wish they had? It's like, there's this great answer I want to give for something, but what would that be? What do you want to say that hasn't been said before? This is your platform, your moment.
Well, I would say that where we are, and just talking in general about everything.
Okay.
I would say that you've got to be very careful not to get caught up in the mass media deception right now of not only the news organizations, but a lot of stuff on the internet is heightened drama to manipulate your emotions.
Oh, yeah.
And so when some bit of news comes out on Facebook and everybody's reacting to it and everybody's, you know, having an opinion, and it's usually the same opinion about how horrible it is or, oh, my God, just step back for a minute and really maybe take a look at it and maybe research it a little bit and see what's really going on there before you
act on emotion.
Let your emotions take you in one direction or another. You know what I mean?
I know what you mean.
I think it's a smart thing to do, because that affects you, and negative feelings and negative emotions bombarding you all the time like that can really turn a person kind of angry and kind of bitter if they're not careful. And you got to be really careful about that. You can't take all this. It's all about selling advertising, and they're selling drama, and they don't care how it affects you.
Right.
So you just have to you have to protect yourself a little bit, you know? I'll give an example. Like, when I write a script or when I finish a film, I, like, have little screenings of it, you know, at my place to get some feedback, and usually it's positive, and everybody's positive, and, you know, there may be one or two comments here or there, but you've got to kind of protect yourself from somebody who's bringing their own garbage to your film. In other words, if they criticize your script overly negative, and you go, wait a minute, I didn't get that of it, I didn't get that at all, I don't know where you're coming from with this, then it's probably them, not your script.
Gotcha.
You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
So, a lot of times it's coming from their own inability to express themselves, you know, their own personality quirks or their own bitterness or whatever it is, then it is your project, you know, and they project those feelings onto something for whatever reason. I don't understand it. I don't know. But
gotcha.
You know, the main thing is to keep learning, keep watching movies, keep reading, and keep on top of the game, and also develop your artistic sensibility so that when you get into editing your movie, you know if something is going to work, and keep working it, keep re-editing it, keep reworking it until it gets down to what really matters and what really works. I mean, I cut a barroom scene. I had so much footage in midlife on this barroom scene to work with, and it started out as like a, I don't know, maybe a 10-minute scene. And I just kept reworking it and recutting it and reworking it until I got it down to like a 3.5-4 minute scene, probably 3.5 minutes.
Right.
And it was then it worked because it was at the essence. It had all the beats that it needed. It had all the information it needed. It had the funny parts. It had a beginning, a middle, and an end. But it was getting it to that, you know?
Right.
And a lot of people, like I just saw Blade Runner.
Right.
I was like, wow. You know, it's almost like a rough cut of the movie, you know?
I know,
we could have taken this story and compressed it into a 2-hour movie that would have been a lot more fun, and we could have, like, added a few more action sequences of maybe him going after a couple other skin jobs that, you know, were listed at the beginning of it. And you know, and intertwine that with the story of looking for the baby, it would have been a much cooler, much more satisfying experience. It just felt like they elongated everything instead of compressed everything, you know?
Oh, yeah, I know. One person said this is the most Kubrick film I've seen since he died. And, you know, it all depends. Like, I did feel like it was long, but I also did really enjoy it. So, it's like, I'm caught in the middle there.
I guess my big problem was that, you know, having the replicant be in love with the hologram girl, they spent a lot of time on that. And I don't know why. I thought it was a good subplot, but it almost seemed to be Kay's main focus was this hologram girl, you know, which they kept coming back to it. I don't know. It just didn't seem to have a payoff.
Well, I saw it like this. I saw, like, you know, if a replicant, if a human, like going back to the first Blade Runner, if a human can find humanity within a replicant, and you have this replicant who's on his own job, you know, he's being called a skin job, and, you know, he's being, you know, criticized and cursed at, and he's finding love and giving love to something that's even more manipulated than him, some creation out of binary code, and showing humanity and love to that. You know, I could see the links, you know, so that's what I saw anyway. That's what I got out of it. So,
yeah, I mean, it looked great and it was well directed and everything. I just felt like, you know, and I know the first one was moody and broody and kind of a slow-paced film, but I felt like they were in love with their footage. In other words, you had these seven-page scenes, and they didn't cut any of it. They left the full seven-page scene in there, you know?
Yeah, I gotcha.
You know, even if you have a seven-page scene, you usually cut it down to 4 pages. You know, by the time you get it edited down, you usually cut it way down. So, I don't know. I mean, it just was, it took the wind out of the line of tension, you know, for me. I felt like it could have been a lot more dangerous and a lot more interesting, you know.
Yeah, hey, that's fine. Nothing wrong with that. Yeah. And speaking of dangerous and interesting, where can people find your stuff? And you?
My website is gtfilmproductions.com, and Midlife and Dark Seduction and now Night Creep are available on VOD platforms. Just punch them into Google and they should come up on their various platforms. Midlife is at iTunes and Amazon, and Dark Seduction's at about 8 platforms, so that's a that should be an easy one to find. And then Night Creep is on Vimeo for now. So,
excellent.
Yeah. And then I have a Facebook, Greg Travis. I have 2 or 3 different Facebook accounts. And, okay. And then there's a Facebook for each one of my films as well, just under the name of the film. Yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. So I'm definitely going to be checking out Night Creep, among others, and I can't wait to hear more about your new horror venture that seems to be quite intriguing from your description. And
Yes, I will keep you abreast of that. It's,
I can't wait.
Yeah, I'm really excited about that. It's, I want to kind of bring some new and old quality. Sometimes we're bringing back some old qualities to a new to a genre. It makes it feel a little new.
Oh yeah, absolutely. No, I like it. I like how you think. So, before I go, ladies and gentlemen, you can find the show, of course, at CrashPalaceProductions.com and on iTunes. Please leave your comments. We love all of those. And, Greg, thank you so much for coming on today. I really appreciate it. You're awesome.
Billy, it was a pleasure. Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
Anytime. So, we'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Okay, and send my best to your sister.
And send me the links, too, and I'll post the show.
Oh, we'll do. We'll do. Alrighty.
Thank you.
Alright, bye. Okay.